to experience, Jackson Snyder presents. We will examine the life of our master Yeshua by discovering his ancestors, family, and friends, by reviewing rare ancient manuscripts, and speaking to those who know him best. From the Vero Essene Yahad, now experience, Jackson Snyder presents. Magnificent. That was the overture to The Light Cavalry, an operetta written by Franz von Suppé. Wonderful piece. Really brings you into the idea of the horse dragoons, the swords flashing, the military band playing, and all kinds of action. Wow. Someday I ought to put together an album of just these beginnings that I put on this show. Just the introductory songs, pieces, musical sketches, masterworks. There are some that are wonderful. I'm choosing what I like. Isn't that a great thing I can do? It takes extra time. But I'm trying to share with you some of the greatest of what we call the old war horses of classical as well as modern music. A lot of times I'll put 15 of these shows on one CD, and I'll put them in the car, and I'll just listen to the intros. And when the intro's done, I'll just flick it over to the next track and listen to the next one. Yes, I should put them all over on one CD. You think if I did that, I could use that as a fundraiser? I've been thinking of some things for fundraisers, because just like at Hebrew Nation Radio, it costs to put together these programs. And my program isn't like the rest. I don't just sit here and talk. I put together a presentation each time worthy of my name, which is a good name. I spend sometimes 5 to 10 hours, even more, on each 50-minute show. Why? Because I want quality. I'd love for those that take the time to listen to what I'm doing to receive the very best of what I'm doing. Not just some recording where I'm up standing at a church someplace. It's got to have music. It's got to have a little humor. It's got to have depth and power. It's got to be something that you wouldn't normally learn someplace else. It's got to be something that's true and real insofar as I can research it. And up until now, it had to have Bogdan Shrumkov. But I'm afraid he's going to be missing for a while. Anyway, we won't dwell on that. Today what I have for you is a review of Robert Feather's Black Holes in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where Feather again makes a connection between the scriptures, the Hebrew people, and Egypt, especially the temple at Amarna, or what was then called Akhetaten. Neither he nor I can figure out why nobody is catching on to this. Of course, I understand why my fellow Hebrew roots people aren't catching on. There's a lot of safety in the status quo, and there's a lot of audience in sensationalism. Never mind the greatest finds of the 20th century, the Dead Sea Scrolls. Never mind them. Who wants to know about them? Never mind the fact that we have discovered that the book of Deuteronomy has been corrupted beyond recognition. Never mind. We don't want to bring those kind of things up. Oh, there are just so many incredible scriptural and archaeological discoveries to declare and then ponder while those of the status quo simply want to go over the same Torah portion over and over and over again. Oh, I need some variety in my life, don't you? You and I, we can't be myrmidons. We can't be camp followers. We have to get out on the forefront of exegesis, on the lip of evangelism, on the cutting edge of what's really to come. And while we're out there, do the best we can to cut away some of this nonsense and drivel that we are fed day after day after day as we each go to great lengths to seek out the truth. Wow! Did that all come out of me now? I can't understand why. Maybe I do. After listening to the Light Brigade two or three times, anybody with a little testosterone in them is going to want to charge, get on that gigantic animal and go. Pull out the sword. Sword of truth, of course. Sink their heels into the shanks of the horse and charge off against the enemy. Oh, well, yes, it's a fantasy. Let's go back and read that same Torah portion again. Somebody wrote to me this week. I've got to tell you, I've been getting a lot of emails, messages, phone calls, which is great. They wrote to me and asked me how it was that I was able to get back to them so quickly on an email. And I wrote to that person because I have pledged to answer every email promptly and every message promptly, and to answer every phone call or get back to whoever leaves a message as quickly as I can. This is the part of the pastoral ministry. If some wonderful people are willing to listen to the things that you have learned and been pent up in you for years and years and take them seriously and send you notes and letters with questions or commendations, wouldn't you want to get right back? Wouldn't you want to make contact? Wouldn't you want to edify that person that wrote you as much as that person edified you by writing? Well, actually, I forgot what else is on this show. I just did it today. I did want to mention to you, you can catch Jackson Snyder Presents at the Vero Esenia Hod 3 times a week, at least live, Tuesday and Friday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and Sabbath at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. We're going to ride that charger through your crowd for an hour and a half each one of those times, and for as long as we have breath. So join us. Here's how you do it. Get on your PC. Go to veroyahad.com. There's a password there. It's meet, M-E-E-T, hyphen, that is dash, 0383. Now, the T is capitalized. And you get on there a little before the times I mentioned, 9 on Tuesday, 9 on Friday, 3 on Saturday. And you can interact. We interact, as you've heard on some of these shows, all the time. Questions come up, questions are answered. If I can't answer them, there's usually 2 or 3 experts on there that can. So come on and join us online at theyahad.com. If you're on an Android phone, you can get us through Skype or through Uvu. Send me an email and let me know if you want to do that. I'll give you the directions. Write to veroyahad@gmail.com. That's the best way and quickest way. Then I'll send you a weekly update when I have time. I'll let you know what's coming up. Well, that email was exciting to me, and so are the rest that come in. And I am so pleased to be able to get back with you. I'll always send you some of my translations in ebook form, free of charge, of course. And we will be friends from then on. We can call each other whenever we want. And we're making a network here of people. Some are real experts in a variety of areas. Education, medicine, health, managing the home, computer science, and even physics. Okay, I guess I've done enough. Welcome again, and I guess now we'll get on to whatever the subject happens to be. Black holes in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Hallelujah. Shine forth. Be clamorously foolish. What else does halal mean? Oh, it means praise. Yes, it's the type of praise that is the hands. It signifies a hand movement. Hands straight up like this. It is a hand gesture, meaning it has happened. Whatever you have been longing for, whatever you have been doing your taudah, your sacrifice of praise for, when that comes to pass, the hands go up into the halal. Just working on the verse 6-8 regarding frontlets. Well, I'd sure like to know what you come up with there.
Trying to think of the context of that. Is that the Tefillin? There's a fellow that we ran into a few years ago at Sukkot who makes leather bracelets. He really didn't know what he was doing, but he used a stamping tool to stamp on there parts of the Shema. He didn't know anything about the Tefillin, but he gave us some of these. I said, you know what you're doing here? You're making a new kind of Tefillin, a new kind of, what do they call those in the Bible? You know, you wrap them around your hands. Okay, Tefillin. You're making a new kind that a person can actually wear. Just a snap, just a wristband. I must have wore that thing for a year. Mine said Shekinah on it. I like that word. You have anything to say today, Rex?
Do I have anything to say today? I'm here to learn, listen and learn right now.
Rex is here to listen and learn. We just made his acquaintance this week, and we had a good time the other day. When was it? Day before yesterday?
Yep.
Sitting around talking. Oh, you brought your tarot cards with you? That's a phone. Phylacteries. Okay. Phylacteries. You think maybe the mark of the beast that they talk about is a kind of artificial phylactery, you know, on your forehead or your hand, something like that? No, it doesn't tell us to put a box on our forehead. Well, the way we understood that is in not in a literal sense, but in a symbolic sense of thinking and doing. All right, we talked about Robert Feather a little bit. Robert Feather, I got one of his books here. I mentioned he was one of my favorite authors on biblical subjects. Here's the latest book I got from him. His first book was concerning the Copper Scroll. He claimed to have found the Copper Scroll treasure. I believe he did. His second book was The Secret Initiation of Jesus at Qumran. What a book. That's the one I told you where they found the headless skeleton in the Qumran cemetery, and he found the head. And then now there's black holes in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where once again, he's kind of carping now because his theories about the connection of the Hebrew religion with Akhenaten, he should call it the black holes in Dead Sea Scroll scholarship, or black holes in Dead Sea Scrolls consensus theory, rather than in the scrolls themselves. And certainly what I thought he was going to be talking about was lacunae, definitely. Holes in the scrolls, specifically, and what to replace in there, but that's not his area of expertise. He's a metallurgist, and now he's an amateur, I would say now professional Egyptologist. He has made it perfectly clear that there is a connection, and a strong connection, between Qumran, or the Qumran materials, and Egypt's Amarna temple, and the worship of Akhenaten, and the Aten, the sun solar disk. Not that the solar disk was worshipped, but that it was a symbol and a real representative of the great deity, the creator behind it. And if you can remember what we were talking about at that time, which was about 1300 or so, 1320 BC, he came from some foreign place to become the pharaoh after Amenhotep III. And his look and his way of doing things was so foreign to Egypt, he couldn't have come from there. We looked at his profile last night, and he appears to be Oriental. That's what we can say. Or, as they called him in those days, Asiatics. Asiatics, by the way, was also a technical term for the Habaru. The Hebrew people were known as Asiatics, and one of the things that Feather makes it clear in this book is that in the Amarna kingdom, in the worship of Akhenaten, in the city of Akhetaten, there were swarms of Hebrews there. This was before the enslavement of the Hebrews. But when Akhenaten's city was destroyed after his death and his religion was again taken over by the priests of polytheism, whom he deposed, then the Hebrews, they had to split. They went south down to the city of the Alphi priesthood, and Alphi just below the Egyptian border where the Egyptians couldn't get at them. They went to the east, back to Canaan, and they went north up to Goshen, where eventually they were enslaved because they were monotheists for one reason, and they had ascended from Akhetaten, which had become anathema to the rulers and priests of Egypt. They did not want to even hear about this religion, this monotheism, this aberrance in Egypt, where the gods that were so important to their daily life were decimated, and their temples were decimated, and their inscriptions were decimated, and they weren't even spoken of for 12 years. I have an article here from the Jewish Chronicle that I would like to read to you. It is in regards to this book, Black Holes in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Then we'll talk just a little bit about the canon, and then I got a couple other pretty important texts to share with you, at least in the time that we have. This article is called The Prophet and the Pharaoh. Note, the author says, modern-day Amarna in Egypt was the site of an ancient city called after the pharaoh Akhenaten, who brought Egypt to the realization of monotheism. Science works on the principle that any theory has to be repeatable under the same experimental conditions, and that a theory that has this characteristic will predict related findings when these are tested. Yes, we learned that in high school science class. Not only are the Dead Sea Scrolls full of obvious memories of the Amarna period, and they are, as one might expect, but there are entire sections of the Bible itself that reflect life at the time of Akhenaten and the geometry of his holy city. If what I claim is correct, it would be surprising if they did not. The book of Ezekiel gives numerous clues that he's not talking about the land of Israel or the temple at Jerusalem when he talks about the holy city and a huge temple. Quote, "The house of Israel and their kings must not again defile my holy name by their apostasy and by the corpses of their kings at their death. When they place their threshold next to my threshold and their doorposts next to my doorposts with only a wall between me and them, they are defiling my holy name." Now, last night, this was a passage that Scott Paddock pointed out, that it's a definite reference to Egypt, because in that day, Israel didn't in no way practice that kind of burial in and about the temple. Well, the article goes on. This kind of practice described has nothing to do with Israelite burial custom. It's clearly a warning to Israel in their new land not to follow the Egyptian pagan practice of building a mortuary temple and housing the dead king in close proximity to the gods of the temple. This was the custom in the burial of kings and officials in ancient Egypt when a mortuary temple was built in front of the person's tomb to accommodate the funeral arrangements and mummification. None of the burials at Amarna included an associated traditional mortuary temple. So Akhenaten gave up that practice. And the issue, it's November 15, 2012. The Jewish Chronicle, number 9097. A careful examination of the geometry of the temple and city described in Ezekiel 40 through 48 demonstrates without any doubt that we're looking at the great temple of Akhenaten and the huge virgin city built for Pharaoh Akhenaten and his holy city dedicated to Aten or Adon. And then he's going to cite a few examples. I was always amazed at this temple in Ezekiel. I wanted to throw that out of Ezekiel because of those dimensions. And besides, I don't think our theology extends toward a third temple in Israel anyway. Evidently, there's a looking back here, and somebody suggested to me a back to the future kind of feeling about this. We're going forward unto yesterday. There's a holy recollection of this temple, and considering Akhenaten was certainly some foreigner and probably an Asiatic, and he had a retinue of Asiatics and a large population coming down to his new city of Asiatics. When I say Asiatics, think Hebrews. And we might be able to understand this a little bit. Any explanation that tries to place this description in the land of Israel and relate it to the temple at Jerusalem is absurd. Claims that the description is purely imaginary also fall because they fail to answer where the knowledge of the landscape and the setting for the building described come from, or why the accounts match so closely the layout and scenario at Amarna. According to Ezekiel 40:44, There were chambers for singers in the inner forecourt. There's no mention in the Bible of singers in the temples at Jerusalem, but depictions of singers can be seen in the side chamber of the great temple at Akhetaten. Now we go into actual measurements again. Various measurements are given in Ezekiel 45, 1 through 7. The total area designated for Adon is 12,500 times 10,000 meters with a cubit at 50 centimeters. I told you I measured my arm. It's just short of 50 centimeters. The area designated for the Levites is 12,500 times 5,000 meters. And the area designated for the city is 12,500 times 2,500 meters. This gives a total area of approximately 12.5 times 17.5 kilometers. Ezekiel 46 also confirms the prophet's knowledge of Akhetaten. Through the high priest of the temple, he is describing. In verse 12, we find, the gate that faces east shall also be open for the prince whenever he offers a freewill offering, be it burnt offering or offering of well-being. Detailed excavations at Amarna under the supervision of Barry Kemp and the work of N.D.G. Davies, whoever that is, Jeffrey Martin and others, support both these points. They show that the area of the city of Akhetaten was defined by 15 boundary stelae and measured approximately 12.5 times 20 kilometers, very close to the city area recorded in the book of Ezekiel. They also support the belief that the gate to the east would have been used by the high priest at Akhetaten. Ezekiel 46:16 makes it clear that the high priest was a hereditary prince, which is inconsistent with the name of the high priests designated in the Bible. No high priest in the Bible is referred to as having previously been a prince. Thus saith Yahweh Elohim, if the prince makes a gift to any of his sons, it shall become the latter's inheritance, it shall pass on to his sons. The high priest officiating at the great temple at Akhetaten was called Meriri or Merari, and he was a hereditary prince. I mentioned again that this same priest who was a hereditary prince is mentioned in the war scroll as the head of a tribe of people at Qumran with the banner of Merari over them in close proximity to the epithet Prince of Light. That would be Merari and Akhenaten. And also in the apocalypses of James that come out of Egypt, the narrator for that second apocalypse, which I have, if you want a new translation of, if you want to read it, is Merari the priest. He's the one that to bring back to James' family the revelations and apocalypse that he received. And he is called a priest there. That's pretty amazing. Also significant is the description of in Ezekiel 47. He led me back to the entrance of the temple, and I found that water was issuing from below the platform of the temple eastward, since the temple faced east. As the man went on eastward with a measuring line in his hand, he measured off 1,000 cubits and led me across the water. The water was ankle deep. We remember this passage. Then he measured off another 1,000 and led me across the water. The water was knee deep. And he measured off a further 1,000 and led me across the water. The water was up to the waist. When he measured yet another 1,000, it was a river I could not cross, for the stream had swollen into a stream that could not be crossed except by swimming. Do you see, O son of man, he said to me, and led me back to the bank of the stream. As I came back, I saw trees in great profusion on both banks of the stream. Well, I was talking to a fellow on Facebook about this. He was really nasty. When I put up the event and described it a little bit in detail regarding the Temple of Ezekiel and the Temple of Akhenaten being perhaps the same, he got very defensive. And what I brought up to him was this passage in Ezekiel 47, the water. Where would we get this kind of water in the Jerusalem temple? He just walks a short way and he goes into a deep, deep river. Unequivocally, this author writes, from this extended description, water in large quantities is flowing into the temple. Remember in Jerusalem, they had a water shortage, which means the temple cannot be in Jerusalem near the Temple Mount.
Well, beloved, we have to take a little break now. We'll be back when it's finished, promise. Just as I promised, Jackson Snyder Present is back now to finish up message and fulfill promise.
Strangely enough, Masonic rituals include tracing boards laid on the floor with ceremonies, which show a large temple, assumed to be that in Jerusalem, with water from a river running through it. I'll never see that demonstration if it's Masonic. The description is consistent with Ezekiel being led around to the outer gate of the temple facing east and then made to walk eastward as his guide starts to measure using a typical Egyptian measuring device. They walk away from the temple towards a very wide river. Taking a cubit, again, is 50 centimeters. The distance from the temple to the edge of the river is 500 meters, as specified by Ezekiel. This is almost exactly the distance from the edge of the great temple at Amarna to ankle depth in the river Nile. A suggestion that the Nile may have altered its course over the years and the distances mentioned might not be applicable today is contradicted by geoarchaeological studies. Fieldwork funded by the Amarna Research Foundation, looking at the course of the river, concluded the river was, in Akhenaten's day, more or less where it is today. The two streams in Revelation, yes. Maybe, what can we say? You know, Revelation tells us there was no temple in the city. If you remember, the temple that was in the sky, it came down and it evolved as it came down. And finally, it ends up hovering over the earth. And it's no longer a temple, but it's a city. 1,500 stadia by 1,500 stadia. Of course, I'm understanding those numbers as symbolic like the rest of the numbers in Revelation. 1,500 stadia, that's huge. That's a Borg ship coming in. I always wondered when I watched those old Star Trek episodes if they didn't get the whole idea of that from the hovering New Jerusalem. Let's see, do we want to go any farther on this? I guess we'll go another page. Yeah, there's only one page left. They did? Are you sure? Yes, there were some temples. There was, besides this Akhenaten temple, there was a temple at Elephantine, north of Akhetaten. The place is called Yeb. We know almost nothing about that temple. All we know is it was sometime after the Amarna temple, and it was full of Jews. That was after they called them Hebrews, and they had become Jews. And then there was the temple that was built about 160 BC when the Zadokites' priesthood was thrown out of the temple in Jerusalem. The offspring of the last high priest went to Egypt and asked Ptolemy the king if he couldn't build the new Jerusalem in what's now Cairo, as per the prophecy of Isaiah chapter 19, which says it would be built in the city of the sun. That specific area that Onias the IV asked King Ptolemy to have was Heliopolis. Heliopolis in Greek is the city of the sun. That's an incredible fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy. There were several priests named Yehoshua in the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. There were about three of them. There was, I can think of maybe one or two. Yehoshua, son of Domnius, was one. Josephus mentions Yehoshua, son of Simon. And there's one more in there named Yehoshua that were priests of the temple during the time of the Roman incursion into Israel. They were all killed. There was another guy in Rome called Yehoshua, son of Ananias, who I think is the resurrected Yahshua, because what he did for 7 years in Jerusalem was cry out in the streets, repent, repent, woe, woe to Jerusalem. Oh, we could do a lot with Revelation, because Revelation's already come to pass. It's already done. And we could go through, and we have, and show with the histories of Josephus that it has been fulfilled, and maybe we'll do that sometime. A defining characteristic of the Nile is that apart from a limited amount of rain, it's the only source of water for the whole of Egypt, and its annual flooding is essential for the irrigation of the land from the further south to the extreme north in the New Jerusalem Scroll. In the New Jerusalem Scroll version of Ezekiel 47, 8 through 12, that's a Qumran scroll, that's a Dead Sea scroll. Oddly, they named it New Jerusalem Scroll. They should call it the New Temple Scroll in Egypt. It has a version of Ezekiel 47 We have one of the clearest confirmations that the river in question near the temple being described is the Nile River. Water is said to emerge from under the threshold of the temple on the eastern side and descend from south of the altar to the outer court to irrigate the entire country. This water, he told me, runs out to the eastern region and flows into the Arabah. And when it comes into the sea of foul waters, the waters will become wholesome. Every living creature that swarms will be able to live wherever the stream goes. The fish will be very abundant. Once these waters have reached there, fishermen will stand beside it all the way from En Gedi to En Eglaim. All kinds of trees for food will grow upon both banks of the stream because the water for them flows from the temple. So why is Ezekiel writing this? Think about it for a while. Let's go on with a little more evidence here. You can't have a fast answer to that question. That's the whole reason for this happening here. Let it sink in. What does it mean? Does it make you curious? Does it make you want to do a little more research? Does it make you just a little bit doubtful about what we have been told about this temple, where it's going to be, when it's going to be? Does it make us a little doubtful of the Pharisaical, rabbinical Sanhedrin that is formed in Jerusalem and the Temple Mount faithful who are trying year by year to bring this temple up upon the Temple Mount when this temple will not even fit up there? It's so big. Eisenman has some really interesting perspectives on this. He thinks that they should shuck the third temple that is described in Ezekiel and let his brother do the architectural work and design of a new temple. He says, we don't want to go back to that Ezekiel temple. It's too big. We don't want to go back to Herod's temple because it was too corrupt. We need a new design. And you've got to understand Eisenman's brother, Peter, is one of the top designers of buildings in the world. Isn't that amazing? I would look him up on the internet. I keep getting Peter Eisenman. I thought, who is this guy? And there, of course, you can find him on Wikipedia. He's a famous architect. But Eisenman thinks that his brother ought to be doing it. And I would think if there was going to be another temple, that something like that should happen. Really? A new design at the Institute? Those are boring people there. They're a boring people. No one has yet put forward a reasonable explanation as to why the sectarians were led to Qumran by their teacher of righteousness. Elior says they weren't led there. And that's what I want you to hear next is an excerpt from one of her speeches that deals with this very thing. Did the Qumran ruins have anything to do with the people of the scrolls? She says, no, they had nothing. Qumran, the ruin, has nothing to do with the people of the scrolls, unless Qumran was a place where a priest would go that got defiled, go there to get undefiled for the 7 days or whatever needs. If you find that design, I wish you would send that to me. Was there a Zadik Mivaker in Egypt? Of course there were. They were everywhere. One of them was the fellow that is given the credit for the earliest gospel, Mark. Mark was the Mivaker of the Alexandria Assembly. It's also said that Matthew had an assembly in Egypt. That would make sense. He was a Levite. And that would be a good area to get into because, remember, the first Dead Sea Scroll labeled as such that was found wasn't found in Israel or Jordan. It was found in Egypt, in the Cairo Geniza. That attachment to the Cairo temple, where they take the old scrolls and old texts and they, instead of burning them, they put them in this Geniza. They don't use them anymore. They found a piece of the Damascus document in there. Now, I know my time is going, but my intention was, after playing the Elior piece, I was going to go on to the Wars of Yahweh, another piece that deals with this, and then to the Damascus document, or what they called at that time, the Zadokite fragment, because it fits right into this. I've got recordings of all these things. So when Ezekiel writing about what I claim is the temple of Akhetaten, Ezekiel tells us himself at the very beginning of his work, he says that in the 30th year, oh my goodness, on the fifth day of the fourth month, when I came to the community of exiles by the Kibar Canal, it was the fifth year in the exile of King Jehoiakim. This information puts the date at the fifth day of the month of Tammuz in the year 593 BC, 7 years before the destruction of the first temple in Jerusalem. It's generally accepted that the book of Ezekiel was edited later than this period, but then one has to ask the question, why is Ezekiel continually talking about oracles concerning Egypt? Why? And especially about a heavenly throne chariot, the Merkavah. So concerned were the rabbis of the Tanaic period and later over the sensitivity of this material that the Mishnah requires that it must only be expounded by a sage that understands his own knowledge. This material was barred from our canon. This is where we're going with this. M. Megillah 4:10 states categorically that Ezekiel's writings on chariots should not be read at all. Now, we'll leave that there because that segues into this 200-year period I was talking about, I wanted to talk about. These books should not be read at all, say the Pharisees. Remember, the Pharisees of that day are essentially the same as the rabbinicals of today. They're the same. It's the same movement. That movement was the only one that really survived the destruction of Rome because the rabbis at that time were willing to compromise their beliefs with Rome. This is one of the reasons the scrolls are full of pejorative material about the Pharisees, those who seek the smooth things, those who seek the smooth neck, because they compromised their faith with Rome in order to get themselves a little city within a city. They're at Javnia or Jamnia. They made a deal for this city. All right, here's the history. We know that in 175 BC, Onias III, the Zadokite and rightful priest, was murdered. He was murdered. His brother Jason, who was named Yahshua, he changed his name to a Greek name. He went to Antiochus Epiphanes and he said, look, I'll be your man in the temple. Just make me the high priest. And so he made Jason the high priest. Jason was usurped by his other brother, Menelaus. And then a Pharisee named Simon sold the whole kit and caboodle of the temple down the vortex to the Greeks, the Seleucid Greeks. The Maccabees come along after their religion had been banned. And yes, they put up a fight. And Judah Maccabee, a fine person, a fine freedom fighter, he defeats the Greeks and gets them out. That's a good thing. I got an email yesterday. Why don't you keep Hanukkah? Why don't you keep Hanukkah? Why do you consider that not a festival of the Jews? All right, this is why I don't. Because the Qumranites, the Essenes, the Nazarenes, they didn't keep Hanukkah either. Because once the temple was cleansed, it was defiled once again by the youngest, or I should say the last Maccabee brother. Remember that Matthias, son of Hasmon, the Maccabee, had five sons. Can we remember who they are? Judas, Simon, Eleazar, Jonathan, and John, right? Okay. It wasn't a pagan celebration. What happened was, by the time Judah died, he was the prince. Judah was the king of Israel, new king. And he had to keep fighting the Greeks because he had so much collusion. There were so many groups like the Pharisees there that wanted the Greeks to come in. They wanted the Greeks to come in because the Pharisees came from Farsi, from Parthia. The Pharisees was a foreign power in Judaism at that time. By the last Maccabee, Jonathan, what did they call him? They had a second name for him. Hyrcanus? John Hyrcanus. Okay. The last brother sold the whole kit and caboodle back to the Greeks. Then he was usurped by somebody else that had an army that was Pharisee-based. What was his name? Simon Shittah? I can't remember exactly. But anyway, Maccabee finally fought and fought against the Greeks. He fought against Israel. He went and stormed Jerusalem. This is one of the Maccabees, killed thousands of people in Jerusalem, defiled the temple himself, and then went on the run, tried to go to Sparta because of the nature of the relationship between the Jews and Sparta. And so Jonathan ended up in a prison and assassinated in prison. That was the end of the Maccabee brothers, and it went down to more and more corrupt Maccabees down through the time until Herod took over. So that was the thing about 175 to about 150 BC, the priesthood, the right and righteous priesthoods cast out. They go over to Egypt and set up the city of the sun. They go over into the wilderness camps to start a resistance movement. The next date that's important is about 80 BC. At this time, the Zadokite movement was again gaining strength, but Alexander, the king of Israel at that time, he was for the Zadokite priesthood, and he tried to bring them back. But he had so much interference from the Pharisees again, to the point where he got fed up with it, and he had 800 Pharisees executed. Then Alexander died, and his wife, Alexandra Salome, this is about 80 BC, she changed course. She brought the Pharisees in to take over the government. Nobody knows why. But she retired, and she allowed the Pharisees not only to take the secular power, but to go into the temple and take over the priesthood. When this happened, the Pharisees got their revenge on the priests that were left over in Jerusalem. And there is somebody in the Dead Sea Scrolls called the Wicked Priest who was trying to kill the Teacher of Righteousness and finally probably did. The point I'm making here is we've got this constant fighting over who's who after the Maccabees, and we have these movements in the wilderness, and now we have the Pharisees in control of the temple. We have these Zadokite priests and their allies all in Egypt and in the wilderness, and they've taken the books out of the temple with them. This is Elior's contention. They take the books out of the temple. What's left in the temple is for the Pharisees to write. Are you getting my drift? And in writing their own scriptures, one of the things that they admit later on to leaving out is any apocalyptic literature, any reference to the priesthood, etc. Now I'm going to let you hear this excerpt of her speech because it takes up from here. This is one of the finest moments in theology, I'm telling you. This part of this speech is one of the finest moments in theology, but you got to know the history. We cannot understand unless we have the history. The guy with the Hanukkah thing yesterday that wrote to me, I said, you cannot know what is right or wrong unless you know your history. Do you know your history? No. If you don't know your history, you're just taking your faith for granted from whoever the power authority is. Your rabbi, your preacher, whatever. Know your history. Know the history of your church, your fellowship. You will be pleasantly surprised, or you will be horrified if you're a Presbyterian. You will be horrified if you're a Catholic.
Hello, friends. I'm back live again. When we did this live, I played an excerpt at this point from one of Raquel Elior's speeches, where she talks about the history of Israel during the time of the Zadokite expulsion and the Pharisaical takeover of the temple and the Jewish religion. That happened from 175 BC up to about 75 BC. During that 100 years, I mentioned a little bit of the history here, but what I didn't mention is that there is another significant date, and that is about 75 AD. At that time, right after the Romans destroyed Israel, destroyed the temple, and what priests were left, they executed, the Pharisees survived by making a deal with Rome, as I said. Rome gave them a place to build a school, and the Pharisees undertook to use the collusion that they had perpetrated in the last 100 years to entirely take over Judaism, including by 135 AD through the Rabbi Akiva and his cohorts and the false messiah Bar Kokhba. The Nazarene movement, the Nazarenes, which were pacifistic through all this bellicose behavior and time, were thoroughly conquered through the sword by the Israelites themselves. We know this because we have found a letter from Bar Kokhba to an associate in the Cave of Letters, which is a whole different story, where Bar Kokhba tells his underling to take care of the Nazarenes, simply because if they wouldn't fight with Israel, if they were going to be pacifist, then they had no use in Israel. And what we have today is the main course of Judaism is hardly what we had in the times of the legitimate priesthood. And I wanted to show that by using another excerpt from a 9th or 10th century Karaite called The Wars of Yahweh, which you can also find at JS Presents underneath this particular recording. there just wasn't room to put them on this recording that goes on the Hebrew Nation Radio because I only have so much time to do that. And I have put these on before. If you go back to a few of the Elior's Brain recordings, then the quote from her is on there. It's lengthy. And if you go back to another section, you'll find the Wars of Yahweh. You need to listen to that too. Because what we have today is a Judaism that's almost totally rabbinic, primarily populated by people who are not historical bloodline Hebraic people, but they are converts in the main to a form of Judaism that we might say was foreign to the Judaism of David, of Yeshua, and certainly the Zadokites and Essenes that we try to follow. I am not meaning to put them down. I'm just trying to show the historical truth behind rabbinical Judaism today. In the main, they're not our friends. They've never been the friends of Essenes. They've been the enemy. The Essenes, in the main, were a pacifistic crowd, with the exception of the Qumran sectarians, who were not pacifistic, but actively preparing for war against the Pharisees and anyone else that would continue to degut the Torah, the customs of Israel, and the Davidic Messianic religion. Today, the Hebrew Roots movement is primarily not Hebrew roots at all, but Jewish roots. And Jewish and rabbinical roots, they are not the roots of the Messianic faith of Messiah Yahshua. If you've listened to enough of these programs, you'll know that by now. We have other roots. Our roots are in the Essene faith. And that's why we're having, for the first time ever, any place, an Essene Roots boot camp here in Vero Beach, Florida, January 21st through the 27th. We're not charging for it. It's by donation. It's going to be one of the greatest educational events, bar none, that can be called Hebrew Roots. And it's not going to have any superstars. You're not going to see Eddie Chumney there. You're not going to see Monty Judah there. You're not going to see any Christians in a tallit. But you're going to have is the first and best opportunity to get your Hebrew roots from actual Hebrews. That is, from Essenes, Nazarenes, their history, their faith, the modern-day historians that promote the true Hebraic faith. And I want to encourage you to come. There's no better place to be in the middle of January than in Florida, especially Vero Beach. So if the lineup of superstars aren't going to be here to teach you rabbinical Judaism, who is? I am. It's for this purpose I am living, to bring Hebrew roots back to Hebrew roots. So if you do come, and I hope you will, expect to see a lot of me, and a lot of Commander Lee, and a lot of Brother Emerson Moe, and a lot of modern education in regards to scripture, science, health, pastoral issues, spiritual gifts, history, Dead Sea Scrolls, Greek apocalyptic texts, New Testament reinterpreted, esoteric training, and practical training as to how you can spread the word. At jspresents.org, at the top of the page, there are a couple of sessions on the boot camp. Listen to them, see what Yahweh's saying to you, and give me a call or send me an email, and I will reply. And now my time is up, and I want to thank you for being so attentive to this rant, understanding that what I say without prejudice, only because since I was a child, I was a seeker of religious truth. And I believe now, many, many years later, I have discovered a lot of it, and I have paid the price in the discovery. Come celebrate it with me at boot camp in January. We'll go to the beach and baptize you in the name of Yahshua Yahweh. If you've never been baptized in that name, now the time has come where you've found someone that can and will do that for you. Amen.